Your pretty face is going to hell. Your ugly mind is going to Bright Club Atlanta.
It's been a rough week. When's the last time you slept?
Oh God, it just, you know, it's not a issue of losing sleep. It feels like I've been sleeping way too much lately.
Have you talked to your therapist at all?
He told me that. Oh, we're rolling.
I'm Nick Tikoski.
I'm Mike Johns.
I'm host and viceroy of Right Club Atlanta,
and I'm the consigliere of Right Club Atlanta.
Once upon a November, we did a thing at Push Push Theater, and now we want to make a full confession.
The idea here is simple: two writers are given opposing concepts on which to write. We give them 7 minutes to speak their piece and sway our unruly crowd.
This episode, Form versus Function. Our first combatant is Sam Mitchell, co-host of the ever-popular podcast Imperial Trouble. Sam brought some of his expertise to us in the form of function.
I see what you did there.
Sam Mitchell, are you ready?
I'm ready.
Right Club audience, are you ready? Sam Mitchell with function in 3, 2, 1. Go.
All I have to say is that form will always follow function. This one line should suffice. I'm sure you've heard of the legend of the one-word college philosophy exam. The one word, why. One confident student writes down a two-word reply, turns the paper in, and walks out. The two words, why not? I wish that I were that bold. Form always follows function, folks. Here's my paper. Good night. Good luck. Well, like any paper, I need to give attribution to the work that isn't mine. The aesthetic wisdom that I have given you belongs to Frank Lloyd Wright's mentor, Lewis Sullivan. And even Wright's most well-known work, Falling Water, serves a function. It's a home, a shelter, a place to keep us dry from the rain, warm in the winter, and until 3 years ago, a good investment. It's a perfect example of form following function. But if you've ever paid attention to a bodybuilding competition, you'd realize that these athletes are trying to avoid this vital law. You might think that the bodybuilders are the ideal representation of how strength should appear in human form. The ridiculous posing and flexing only highlight the fact that you're seeing men and women who have been starving and dehydrating themselves so their muscles appear closer to their skin. Their waists and legs are skinny by comparison to their bee-stung, swollen upper bodies. They are not the model candidate for pulling an airplane with a harness or placing Atlas stones on high platforms in record time. You clearly need a person named Magnus, Svend, or Thor to do this kind of work. A person who still has fat reserves, a thick core and beefy wide legs with a neck that matches in girth. Someone who could defeat a bear in the wild with their naked hands. And speaking of bears in the wild, Bear Grylls may not be a hammer-wielding Norse god, but I'm confident that he could get you safely through the woods to grandmother's house. I don't think that anyone with calf implants or an oiled chest could do this with the ease that he could. Although grandmother better have mouthwash ready for you when you get there, just in case he's made you drink your own piss after you run out of water. Look, I'm obviously not a bodybuilder, but I did start indoor rock climbing this year, and what I realize is that women are naturally better than men. They aren't trying to out-muscle each other like men tend to do. They embrace the wall like a hug and move up the sheer surface with ease. Women climbers have go muscles, not show muscles. The first time I heard that comparison, I thought back to my dad when he was working at the mill. My friend Brandon was interning there while going to school at Tech. Tired of hearing my dad ribbing with phrases like, "Hey, egghead, for a smart guy, you sure are a dumbass." Brandon, in a show of machismo, challenged my father to an arm wrestling match in the work cafeteria to try to assert his dominance in the blue-collar arena. Brandon, who appeared larger and more muscular, was stunned when he didn't win. He had not considered that my dad's chopping wood every night and taming wild horses for fun had rendered his wiry frame with practical go muscles that outperformed his younger show muscles. This was probably the first time that a conflict had been successfully resolved through arm wrestling since the classic 1987 Stallone film Over the Top. Chopping wood and taming wild horses can build an appetite. You might be craving the most savory boneless duck stuffed inside a boneless turkey, boneless chicken deep fried within a turkey, or a half-pound patty of the fattiest beef served between two glazed donuts, or you may just want dessert. Mascarpone sculpted over layers of shortbread, styrofoam, and wooden dowels made to look like Hogwarts. But before you can eat that turducken, the Luther burger, or that award-winning Harry Potter cake that gets noticed as a fantasy nerd masterpiece, we must simply face the fact that it is food. Food that we may not need to eat, but food that is still transformed into energy that allows us to function. Energy that allows Stallone to triumph in the World Arm Wrestling Championship and finally win the respect of his estranged son. Function triumphing over form is also apparent with some dogs. Hunting and working dogs are bred for their intelligence, speed, and instincts. Show dogs are bred to be pretty. Well, when we screw around with the nature for the desire of aesthetics, sometimes the results aren't so great. We get attractive, purebred canines with hip dysplasia and general poor health. Now look, I'm not suggesting that we start breeding for function. This isn't Sparta. All right, I don't want anyone throwing their sick babies off cliffs or taking their 8-year-olds to the wilderness to fend for themselves, even with the help of Bear Grylls. And before the Spartans were practicing eugenics, early man may have been tired of stepping on his hot blacktop driveway just to get his junk mail. So he started covering his feet in leftover cowhide. Then he fashioned waffle soles, pumps, and even the Reebok pump. And now we have small museums and art shows dedicated to the shoe. We've taken an item of function and have pushed it past its limits to the point where the design has started to devolve into footwear like Crocs. All right, clothing has led to fashion design. So in turn, function again has led to form. And Tim Gunn need not critique superhero costumes, okay? Batman doesn't wear a flexible band across his midsection to divide the blacks and the deep likes of his crime-fighting ensemble. He needs his freaking utility belt for beating up the Joker and holding a shark repellent. In the beginning, before dogs, before footwear, and even Batman, the Earth was a formless void. Some say that God quickened the world with his own word and hung the stars in the night sky. But whether you believe in God or not, we can all agree that the stars were there way before us. Is their purpose only to shine, or are they also there to guide us at night like a map? Are they just the remnants of an enormous mass that still generate heat and light? I don't know. We are all made of stars, to quote the popular astrophysicist Moby, who in turn was quoting Carl Sagan when he said, "We're made of star stuff," meaning the atoms and elements that were floating along in the outer reaches from billions of years ago are in our bodies right now. My ancestors, my future child, and his children's children are, on a basic quantum level, made from the stardust of our universe's past. Every creature on Earth, everything with matter, shares this with each other. To me, this is one of the most romantic ideas I have ever heard. The long-dead stars, whose light we still may be seeing, may have a grander purpose than illumination. Maybe their real function is to remind us that we are all the same. All the beauty that you've ever beheld will ever behold in your lifetime, and all that our descendants will ever see, feel, and create is related. Form cannot exist without function, but function's function, if you will, is to support beauty, just as the canvas of a beautiful painting cannot be supported without the frame that it's stretched over. So, to the philosophy professors who ask why, or to anyone who asks, why do you feel the need to create? The answer is simple. We are human, the children of star stuff. Simply, it is our function.
Going up against Sam was the lovely Ingrid Sibley, founder of Abacus, Art of Storytelling. This evening, she spoke to us in the form of our favorite muse, the burrito.
I'm putting 7 minutes on the clock.
Thank you, Nick.
You're welcome. Ingrid Sibley, are you ready?
I'm so ready.
Ingrid Sibley, are you sure you're ready?
I'm really, really ready. I'm really ready.
Okay. I'm really ready. Wait, Michael Bonitz, are you ready? Ingrid Sibley with Form in 3, 2, 1. Begin.
Tonight, we take a journey to the most perilous corner of Atlanta, at the intersection of Ponce de Leon Avenue and Somerset Terrace. Some of you may recognize the corner and sigh, thinking of the treasures found at the kitsch dealer Paris on Ponce or the basement-turned club, MJQ Concourse. Others will experience a cold shudder, envisioning nighttime transgressions at Murder Kroger. But tonight, we go to the most dangerous nook of all, Chipotle, for the first installment of the Chipotle Chronicles. In tonight's installment, you will hear how the writer herself became victim of a Chipotle-related incident when a friend, who will go unnamed for security reasons, told the writer that Chipotle was responsible for him standing her up. That's right, he was forced to stand in a line for 2 hours. Now imagine, if you dare, a place with such a cultish clutch over its consumers that they would stand in line for nearly 2 hours just to regale in pinto beans and chunks of cilantro. We shall now explore the only possible scenario that could subjugate a group of people to any fast food joint for 2 hours. In tonight's installment, Escape from Barbacoa. The story begins with an assessment of said establishment and a profile of the typical Chipotlerino. Let us examine the founder, Steve Ells. Ells meets all the criteria of a cult leader, gently hypnotizing eyes masked by unassuming glasses, unique dress style, dimple overabundance, and a determined inflexibility. He implements cult tactics through Chipotle's premier seller, the bowl. For what is a salad bowl if not an exclusionary bonding tool, dashing simple salad eaters to the wayside, upping the stakes with crunchy edible containers and diced meats? In order to assess real cult members, those ruled by the bowl, as I have not fallen victim to Chipotle, I turn to the most accurate surveyor of modern culture and the encyclopedia of our times. Yes, Facebook. I ask for their fave Chipotle dish. Their answers appeared straightforward, but were clearly coded, please. Veggie burrito, the size of my head. Translation, my mind is under culinary attack. Please, dear God, help. Vegetarian salad bowl, vegan style, romaine, black beans, rice, pico, onions, jalapenos, double guac, and hot sauce. Translation, Els, through inundating me with choices, has given me a false sense of control while stripping me of all real power. Why are you sitting there? For Christ's sake, help me. Veggie or chicken burrito, spicy. Bring me one. Translation, I am reaching out to pull you into this dark world of bowl. No one is safe. Yes, friends, this fast dining restaurant has the capacity of destroying all around it. Friendships, workplaces, households. We must not scoff at the idea of standing in a fast food line for 2 hours. Rather, we must weigh the power of the burrito bowl. Now back to the incident at hand. On this fateful night, Martha Reinhart stands at the head of a forming line at the corner of Ponce and Somerset, her eyes crazed and her mouth covered in drool. She has gotten what Chipotlerinos refer to as the taste. For a specific bowl, the barbacoa, replete with green salsa, cheese, black beans, rice, and lettuce. Martha reaches over the counter to snatch her bag from the cashier, proceeding to rip her fork open with her teeth and dig into her bowl. At the same moment, my friend enters, feeling fortunate to be merely the fourth person in line. His closeness to the counter excites him as he is lost in thoughts of me and in a hurry to be by my side, stuffing my poised lips with forkfuls of pico and adobo. It has the spice of the barbacoa, but is definitely missing something. It's our standard barbacoa, ma'am. Completely tangless. You can feel her heart dropping into a sea of bland. Her fork stirs the bowl with tornado-like fury before shoving another forkful in. No, 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 the corn is undercooked. I want to write the company about this. Completely unheard of. A bad barbacoa. The cashier, with bowed head, pulls a complaint form out of the drawer and suddenly hands it to the woman, still complaining about her meal, forkful by forkful, at what is now developing into a 50-person line, stretching out the door and towards the tattoo shop. She gets the form and freezes, the word complaint jumping out at her, and jerks upright. I don't want this. I just want a request form. Ma'am, we only have complaint forms or commendation forms. The woman, determined to not sign her name to any paper appearing anti-establishment, points to the computer and asks if they can change the heading on a commendation form to a request form. Meanwhile, my friend stands behind the commotion, eyes tearing in frustration, for he is too close to the counter to leave, but too far to call me. He has to wait it out. In the background, he hears the cashier telling his manager that the ink has run out on the printer, and he must ride his bike down to Staples to purchase more. At this, my friend looks down, sees the time, and notices that his phone is dying. He falls to his knees, cursing Chipotle for the hold over him that has kept his feet buckled in place. At this outburst, the faces around him begin to sour, and he hears a locking of the door. He does not remember what happened next or how he got home, and definitely wasn't able to call me because he woke up to a dead phone and was strangely too weak to plug his charger in. Having forgotten the travails of his evening, he never realized that Chipotle was to blame for his indiscretions. When I saw him days later, it was either the diced tomato-sized welts or the overwhelming stench of hot tortilla grease that allowed me to forgive him. By the next weekend, we were eating a burrito bowl over candlelight. We made the most beautiful crunching sounds together, faces full of carnitas, hearts full of guac. Sometimes, when I say the word barbacoa, he convulses. But we just chalk that up to him being hungry and head to Chipotle. Please stay tuned for the next installment, Guacify Wall Street. Thank you.
All right, that's it for us. So, to which school of thought do you subscribe? Are you a formalist or a functionarian?
Yes, that's a word.
That's totally a word.
Mike wrote that.
Yeah. Let us know. You can get in touch through writeclubatlanta.com or through our Facebook page. You can follow us on Twitter at writeclubatl, and we're also on iTunes. You barely have to do a thing to touch us.
Our webmistress is Jamie Howard. Our collaborators at Push Push Theater in Decatur are Tim Habiger, Shelby Hofer, Claire Christie, and Jeremiah Prescott.
Word.
Word. Write Club's founder and overlord is Ian Belknap, who will come out from under that bridge and eat you and all of your goat brethren if you don't check out writeclubrules.com. Until next time, I'm your viceroy, Nick Tkosky.
And I am consigliere Mike Johns.
And it was the best of times.
What?
It was the worst of times.
No,
it was the combination best of times and worst of times. Oh, Charlie.